Hello, welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Parasite and Last Christmas, which I guess you could liken them both to each other by saying they're both about family. But that's the biggest stretch
what movie,
of all time.
What movie isn't about family? You know? That's like asking a presidential candidate if he or she supports family. Yes, I'm in favor of family.
Well, these are two very, very different families, I will say.
I will say that too.
Yeah. So we'll start with Parasite.
All right.
And where to start? It's a tragicomedy of, you know, it's humorous, it's horrifying, it's sad. It's got an interesting take on the struggle to succeed.
That's what I love about this director, Bong Joon-ho. And I'll point out that Parasite won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival. That's the top prize there. It's the first Korean film to ever win that. If you follow Korean cinema, they've been making a lot of strong films for a few decades now, and they certainly have gotten critical recognition and some commercial success, but to finally get the top prize, it can. And of course, I teach here at Howard Community College on Asian cinema. It's kind of tough to program that sometimes because you only get like two or three films for each country as you go around Asia. But one of the films I use for Korea is an earlier film by Bong called The Host, which I absolutely loved. It's one of my favorite monster movies of recent years. And yet, as I say monster movie, it is and it isn't. And this is alluding to what Marie just mentioned, that one of the signal attributes of this director is that he engages in genre play or genre hopping. You sign on and you start watching thinking you're going to get one thing, and then he switches gears and gets something a little different. And it's a reminder that films don't have to exist within a single box. Some of the most interesting films qualifies this and also is that. So like with The Host, on the face of it, it's a monster movie because, you know, in the Han River in Seoul, this creature, however you want to describe it, comes out of the water and then, you know somehow produced by nuclear waste and so on. And then, you know, you'd say, okay, it's a monster. And it's really delightful because monster movies are supposed to scare you and also make you laugh. And it does both those things. But ultimately, it's a family comedy slash drama. So even once it switches gears and becomes more of a family-oriented film, even there, it's funny, but it's also heartbreaking. It's all those things, and he makes it work. And what I like so much about Parasite is that it does that. You start watching it thinking it's going to be one thing, and it is all the way through, but then there's some other elements tossed in. And we have to be really careful in discussing this film not to spoil it too
right,
much.
Right.
There are some genuine spoilers involved here, but just to say that those things will occur, there'll be some complications to take the movie in different directions. So it's both a comedy and it's also a tragedy in a lot of ways.
I'm not familiar with The Host, but I am familiar with its director's movie Mother, which is a murder mystery. And the interesting thing about, you know, sort of the play on words is because of the phonetic differences between English and Korean, both mother and murder are spelled the same when translated to Korean characters. So the movie title, you know, it's a play on the similarity, and it's an interesting way to sort of preview what it's going to be about. In a sly way.
It's a great thing to mention because, you know, here's a thematic connection. Just as the film title Mother has that reverb to it, Parasite functions the same way. Because to give our audience at least a sense of the storyline, the premise of it, you have two families here, so it's a family story. You have a working class family, to the extent that they work, and actually that's something in The Host.
They're putting together pizza boxes.
Well, in The Host as well, it's a working class family. It's sometimes not working all that much. But anyway, in this case, the working class family, I'll call them that, they have a basement apartment, and the job, the main job they share, the labor they have there, is assembling pizza boxes. Now, I've got to say, they didn't do a very good job of it. And so there's a lot to consider there. It's comic and not comic, but the fact that that's the one family. And this is a film that has a lot to do with class differences. You know, to have a working class family like that, and they are the obvious parasites. So you notice the film title Parasite is singular, but it probably should be plural or could be plausibly given as a plural because the working class family is parasitical in this regard. A member of that family goes to work for a wealthy family, upper middle class to wealthy. And one of the really striking things visually and sociologically in the film is as you go from place to place, like think of it like parallel editing, as you go from one place to the other back and forth, the basement apartment is so squalid, and we can talk some more about some of the horrible things that happen there. You would not want to live there, right? It's really squeamish at times, and certainly just uncomfortable to have the whole family packed into a small apartment like that, and the subterranean conditions, if you will. So anyway, when a member of this poor family goes to work for the wealthy family, just the architectural contrast between the basement apartment and the modernist house. It's modernist with a vengeance. It's so spare, like where would you even put dirty laundry? It's just like this house is like near perfect, right? Everything
very
looks
sterile.
It's right out of a Shelter magazine. It looks great. And it is sterile. And one of the great things that the director does visually, and he's really kind of sneaky and subtle and sly oftentimes. You may not even notice it first, but the family packed into that basement apartment, they're at such close quarters, they're literally crowding the film frame. It's like a wrestling match. They're all on top of each other. They're all over the place. Then when you cut to the modernist house, the family there, there is a sense of sterility, of spareness, of distance. You rarely see the family members in the same frame. Somebody's downstairs talking to somebody upstairs. Somebody's outside, somebody's inside, whatever. Somebody's
peeking around the stairwell, eavesdropping.
Or if you're sharing the living room, you're at one end of the room, and it might as well be Xanadu and Citizen Kane, and somebody else is at the other end of the room. And so much is said by that. The whole mood, the tone, the visual palette, the look of the film changes there. But back to the parasitical quality of it, the obvious parasites are the poor family members, because first one member of that family goes to work for the wealthy family, and then finagles it in such a way that other members of the poor family are all working for the rich family. And the rich family doesn't quite realize what the setup is here, that they're really being milked. They're being drained by all these members. And in effect, the poor people are moving into the rich people's house, if you will. But so that's the obvious parasite in terms of, you know, the poor family taking advantage, if that's the way to put it, of the rich family. However, in their own way, the rich family are just as parasitical, because they are taking advantage of all this low-cost, almost no-cost labor in a way. And in terms of class values, class distinctions, the way in which the upper class is living very, very comfortably, and it's the poor people working for, we don't know the exact wages, if you will, but, you know, the sensibility is sort of like minimum wage or at least low wage. And that's how you remain wealthy like that. You have somebody to do the cooking and the cleaning and all that, and you pay. And so in their own way, they're being parasitical. They're taking advantage. And, you know, you can have a very comfortable life when somebody else is doing the laundry for you.
Well, that house that you mentioned that the Rich Parks family lives in was a set built completely from scratch. The fact that the son first gets a job as an at-home tutor was chosen because the director realized that that job was the only way the two families from the extreme ends of the class spectrum in modern-day South Korea could cross paths convincingly.
Yeah, and one of the reasons I like the film so much, and I by the way, I think this is one of the best films of the year.
I do want to mention that it is the official submission of South Korea for the best international feature film.
And I happily submit to it. I think it's a really great film. And, you know, usually I'm so grouchy and I'm complaining. Even when I like something, I say, yeah, I like it, but here are 33 reasons why I'm not too crazy about it. You know, I'm always carping that way, and I know that. But it's difficult to carp here when the film is so strong. And you know, admittedly, I come in, I'm on his team, if you will. I like this director a lot. I'm inclined to like it. But you know what? You know, it's a long film, and there are enough places where it might go wrong, you know, theoretically. And yet it avoids all of that. I mean, this is a film that has had... In fact, this film is so highly regarded that I'm usually not a big believer in what I call aggregate film criticism, the Rotten Tomatoes type, because it's sort of film criticism by committee, by mathematical formula and so on. It doesn't get into real critical discussion. It's people haggling over the numbers. Well, this film had a 76 and that film had an 83. And you know, you sort of trade numbers as you would otherwise have, you know, something with some intellectual heft to it. But instead, you're just trading numbers. But I will point out, I'll be hypocritical here, and we'll point out that this, like, for Rotten Tomatoes, I think it was like 99% positive ring. And we're going to find the one guy who didn't like it. Wherever he is, we're going to find him. And the thing is that, you know, a film like this, you know, the top prize at Cannes, really universally, near universally good reviews, really strong box office for a Korean film released in this country. what's not to like, if you will. And it just really follows through on the premise, on the setup. It's really consistent that way. And it really, again, has emotional depth to it. The fact that you really care about both families. It's not presenting one as the hero and the other as the villain, right? You have reason to like and not like. I mean, this poor family, you know, some filmmakers would have them as working class heroes. But the great thing about Bong is he shows they're just as flawed, just as craven. They sin as much as anyone can sin, right? There's not a lot to say for them at times. They're really kind of not despicable, but they do some things that aren't so nice at times. But when you look at the wealthy family, okay, they could be obvious targets, as in the haute bourgeoisie and this and that. But in their own way, they're good people, and they're trying to do well and so on. And they have a mix of attributes, positive and negative. And so when you get this combination of the poor and the rich like this, you really get a sense of, you know, two very different lifestyles in the same country. How can you not, in terms of income gap, in terms of that growing income gap, how can you not make thematic connections between that and, you know, push come to shove, United States of America, where you also have that kind of income gap, and how rarely oftentimes groups like this intersect. And when they do intersect, it's because, you know, the hired help, if you will. You know, and in this Korean system here, you know, what would bring the families together? Well, you have servants, but you're right, specifically in terms of getting close that way, a tutor. That's a great bit in the script, isn't it? Because sometimes you have household help and they're almost anonymous.
Right.
It's like the guy pushing the lawnmower kind of thing, right? Like
people in the background.
Yeah, people like background, and they get their wages and they speak when they're spoken to kind of thing, right? But here, when to have the tutor come in, the tutor makes a connection with the family, specifically with the daughter there, where it really does become more deeply enmeshed, doesn't it? And that's so plausible here that he literally has access to the family and is there and in a meaningful way. And that's where these two levels of these two strata, if you will, of society have to communicate more directly. And then we should very quickly add that this is the family coming in to work for them. They already have a housekeeper who's been there. So we get layers, generational layers in a way, of families coming in.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and project that this is going to be the winner for Best Foreign Film, because most of the time when we get around to the nominees, I haven't even heard of the films, or they haven't even come to the area. So the fact that this one has gotten so much attention and so many people have seen it, this is the one to beat.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you. Yeah.
This was shot in 77 days, by the way, which is actually kind of incredible when you think about it, because production-wise, it looks really good.
Well, you know, Bong technically is a really gifted filmmaker, and you know, I'm a movie geek that way, and I love the way he constructs his scenes. I mean, you know, we're discussing it on the radio, so I can't visually illustrate everything for you. But if you actually were to go back and sort of look at the way shots are framed, the way in fact, I'm so glad you mentioned the construction of that modernist house, because he really works with a set in the same way. Like if Hitchcock's making Rear Window, he's going to build the whole apartment building on a soundstage, you know, and you're going to get the architecture exactly as he wants it. And then in terms of the mise-en-scene, the character placement and the camera movement, all that's worked out so carefully. And Bong, again, as a technician, he knows. And that's another reason to just urge people to watch The Host. Watch how carefully shot it is. And like in the action scenes where the monster's rampaging, just watch how he choreographs the action. It's beautifully shot. Even though I should be screaming in terror, I'm saying, what choreography?
Look at that.
And that scream, what a scream as she turns her head kind of thing, you know. But again, that's where a filmmaker is a filmmaker. It's not just selling the storyline. It's thinking aesthetically about how to present it. And not to get fussy about it here, but this film is very carefully framed. All those elements in terms of the two houses, if you will, are so carefully calibrated. Just to cut from that basement apartment to the modernist house, I mean, it gives you whiplash sometimes, the jarring contrast.
Well, speaking of the sub-basement house, I do want to tell people who go see this movie that in the flood scene, that's face mud mask you're seeing giving that sewage that look.
I don't know if that's a selling point for the
film.
I don't know if
we'll like to see it. Makes people feel better because it looks so realistic.
I got to tell you,
it's just face mask.
There's a scene where if you live in a basement apartment, you always worry about this.
Yes,
right? Overflow. Oh, I'll call it overflow.
Yes.
But also the fact that
dramatic,
you know,
dramatic overflow.
But there's also a great Wi-Fi joke relating to the cramped quarters underground.
Yes.
Like you know, if you have trouble getting you know connections and this and that, but it's such a cramped apartment that the bathroom is like this is sort of like the South Korean equivalent of a really cramped New York apartment. apartment where, like, your kitchen is right next to your bathroom. And, like, there's some New York apartments where, like, the bathtub is actually right in the kitchen and the mm-hmm. commode's just off to the side, to put it bluntly. And this basement apartment shared by the whole family is sort of like that. So if you're not getting, like, good reception in one place, it's like, well, if I'm sitting here, I'm not getting as good reception as I like. Maybe if I sit there, well, you're sitting on the commode at that point, probably. So not to go into, like, gross detail, but it's, like, really funny, but, like, gross funny at times as to when you're living like that. And so who can blame this family? Let's cut to the chase here. Who can blame this family to want to get out of that and move into a nice house? That house harbors some secrets and some conflicts and so on, but I don't care. I'd rather suffer in that house than in my basement apartment.
But is it clear from the movie whether they're squatting or whether they're actual tenants?
That's a really good question to ask. I mean, they're clearly living there, but the implication might be squatting.
How would you rent such a place? I mean, how would you even describe it?
Well, you know, they're desperate people, so someone out there would live there better that than the street, okay? But they're practically on the street in some ways. Yeah, but that's actually, like joking aside on that, it's one of the more really, really revelatory aspects of the film is, like, you know, it really gives you a sense of when people are just scraping by, right? And if their behavior's not always the nicest, well, if you were living in that apartment, if you had to live like that, would you always be polite? Would you always have, you know, the best of manners? Maybe not. And would you consider doing something that's, like, if not exactly illegal, at least, like, unethical in terms of how you sell? Like, when they go to work for this wealthy family, to put it mildly, they embellish their resumes to the extent that they have resumes as to, like, what have you done? What experience? Whatever.
But they can do the jobs. So that, I think, is not really the moral conundrum.
Well, but if you lie in order to get the job, I mean, somewhere there's a father confessor who wants to hear your confession.
Well, but that doesn't even come into play.
No, not at all. But see, that's one of the great things about the film is that it's so wide-eyed, open-eyed. This is how life is. You know, if you live under those conditions, man, you're going to do what you have to get a better job. And they just out and out lie. They really deceive the wealthy family. But you're right. Once they get the jobs, they know how to do the jobs. That's not really a question. I wouldn't trust them to themselves if they're in the house by themselves for the weekend. Again, I don't want to spoil anything, but they have some fun when they're living there by themselves occasionally.
Well, I think the movie does have something to say about, you know, how people can tell, by the way, that you are not, that you don't belong. And one of the things that comes up is that the poor family smells like the subway.
Oh my goodness, that's one of the best things about the film. There are, like, 101 really great things about this film. But the fact that the lower class family has a distinctive smell, and it sounds crude to put it that way, but a lot of the jokes in the film come off of that, because it's the man in the wealthy family in particular has a really well-developed olfactory sensibility, and he sort of knows you by your smell as much as by anything you say. And he does that. It's very funny dialogue. It's like, well, they I don't know what it is about them. He's saying that they smell like the subway. and then, of course, talk about self-consciousness. Then, like, the poor family, they're sort of, like, sniffing themselves, like, do we really? But, you know, the ways in which when I talk about different social levels or strata, what sets people apart in terms mm-hmm. of appearance, speech patterns, and yes, on that odoriferous level, you know, when you're wealthy and when you're not so wealthy, when, yes, you probably do smell like the subway.
Yeah, unfortunately. Well, this brings us to our second movie, which is Last Christmas, which
talk
is
about
we're
going
to have
smells.
To take a hard right. Now, don't tip your hand. But it does have a person who is basically homeless as a character, played by Emilia Clarke. This movie is about a woman finding love during Christmas while dealing with a heart condition, set to music by George Michael, who died of a heart attack on Christmas Day.
I'm crying already.
George Michael himself worked at a homeless shelter, although anonymously. That's another tie-in with the movie. And Wham! Donated all the royalties of the original song to Ethiopian famine relief. So,
well, I'll do credit for that.
You have to give it some credit. It really is a movie for fans of Game of Thrones who want to see Emilia Clarke do something else, and for people who like music by George Michael. You get a brand new unreleased song in there if you are a fan. Also, if you look carefully, Andrew Ridgeley can be seen among the crowd during the Christmas show.
Well, something tells me I'm not a fan of this film. Parasite is one of the best films of the year, and it's too easy and kind of snide to say that Last Christmas is one of the worst, but it's one of the more negligible films of the year. Let's put it that way. And first of all, within that Christmas genre, if we can call it that, I mean, I've occasionally written and talked over the years about Christmas movies as a genre, and talk about a saccharine overdose sometimes. You can really, even with films you like, you can sort of have your fill after. It's like, you know, the usual mall experience. If I hear that song one more time, kind of thing. And this film does tend to lean on the material that way. And so obviously you like the film more than I did. And one of the things I didn't care for was if Parasite had a spoiler or spoilers we really, you know, in all honesty, you know, couldn't or shouldn't reveal. And we did a good job. We didn't spoil anything. Last Christmas has a big whammy of a spoiler. And I won't begin to tell you what it is. But when it hits in the film, my reaction was, I'll keep the language clean. My language was a variation on Oh Brother.
Well, I don't even think that the twist even matters. The movie is about this girl and her relationship with her boss and with her family, and that's where it really shines. That's where the script by Emma Thompson
has a role in it. Yeah.
Yes, it has these moments of brilliance in terms of the lines that some of the characters get. Emma Thompson plays a Croatian immigrant. Of course, she wrote herself the best lines. She has many funny lines. And the other comic relief are these two cops that keep wandering through the scenes. Their lines are really funny, too.
Well, what to say? there's brilliance in the Christmas lights. It's so superficial that there are glimmers of what fuller characterization might give to it. For instance, Emilia Clarke, she plays this elf in A Christmas Shop. So a lot of the gags are essentially sight gags, if you will. You put someone in an elf outfit, right? And some of the lines hit and some miss in terms of scripted dialogue, but just visually. But even that, for my money, kind of wears thin after a while. How many elf jokes can you have? You know, if you're wearing an elf outfit and you go out into the street and, it's sort of, okay, funny. But where I'm saying, in terms of like potential, not really fully realized. When she works in the shop, she works for a character who's going by the name Santa, which makes sense because it's selling Christmas paraphernalia. And Santa's played by Michelle Yeoh, which is actually a good role for her. The one scene that works for me so well is that, why do you call yourself Santa kind of thing? Mm-hmm. But when the Michelle Yeoh character mentions all of the previous jobs she's had and all the names or nicknames she's gone by, it's really a well-written little speech, and it hints at like a backstory of not so much a former life as just a fuller life, and the film could use a lot more of that. I think the film just kind of coasts on its premise and then just has fun to the extent that it has fun, really, with the seasonal decor and so on. It doesn't really have a very deep sense of character there. And again, Emma Thompson, is co-scripting it, and she does tend to give herself some of the best lines. And if you're writing your own script, give yourself a good line.
That's a good one. That's for my character.
Yeah, that's mine. I don't blame her for that.
They filmed this on location in London, and in order to avoid crowds interrupting the filming, they would start filming at 2 a.m.
Yeah, they've also avoided crowds in the movie theaters. The film didn't open particularly well, and I think it's going to get lost in the shuffle of it's among releases. Let's talk in pragmatic marketing terms. Christmas hits earlier every year, as you know, and so this is among the early crop of Christmas movies, and because it didn't open well, it's going to fade, I dare say, by Thanksgiving, and it's not going to play beyond that. And that's always an issue with Christmas movies, like how early to open them. And I think eventually they'll be opening in August, but just simply as the decorations come out of the box.
Well, when I saw it, there were lots of people in the theater. It was the opening weekend, and they all laughed. So I think there were probably a lot of Game of Thrones people in there because, that's what people mostly know Emilia Clarke for. And if you are seeing this as a Game of Thrones person, during the scene where Kate's father drives her home in his cab, check out her wrists because you can briefly see her dragon tattoos. She got the tattoos during the final season of Game of Thrones as an homage to her character. And another thing worth knowing is that the character's sickness over her heart condition in the film eerily and perhaps intentionally mirrors Emilia Clarke's own brush with death during the early seasons of Game of Thrones. In 2011 and 2013, she was struck by two separate brain aneurysms that nearly killed her.
Huh.
There's also a tie-in book that is going to be released with the movie, written by Emma Thompson and husband Greg Wise, with essays regarding the meaning of Christmas, Last Christmas, memories of Christmases past, and hopes for the future. The book features contributions by Andy Serkis, Caitlin Moran, Olivia Colman, and Emily Watson.
You know, I have so many books on the book pile. I don't think I'm going to add that one, but it's good to know about it. But, you know, joking aside there, with Emilia Clarke, the performance is fine. And in fact, I think she's got the potential to have a really nice career post the series, you know, the TV series. However, her character's so perky that for me it was sort of like an overdose of perkiness at times. But, you know, strictly speaking, she gives a good performance. And we haven't really to any extent mentioned the man with whom her character, Kate, becomes involved. The elf has an interesting relationship with a guy known as Tom, played by Henry Golding. And so, you know, there is that romantic, and you know, this is a girl meets boy story, among other things. And we can't spoil it to any extent, but the fact that I think the audience for it might well be what I call an ancillary audience. I think the people who saw it with you and laughed with you, that was most of the audience for the film.
You're probably right about that.
But I'm being snarky, I know. But what I'm thinking is, and joking aside on that, I think really because she's so well known from the series, and Game of Thrones, you know, is so incredibly popular, I think people will probably want to catch up with it one way or another. It's the sort of thing where people may not want to see it first run necessarily, but at some point they'll probably want to watch it. And then, you know, by Christmas Day, it may be available on multiple platforms.
You're so cruel.
I know.
It is not the best movie you've ever seen. It's also not the worst movie you've ever seen. It's definitely something to watch if it comes out on DVD. But I think you might be surprised. I think this is one of those movies that girlfriends shopping together or mom and daughters out together, I think that they would pick up this movie as, you know, it's a Christmas movie. You know, your expectations aren't that it's going to be an Academy Award caliber kind of stuff.
Well, that's
it's meant to make you feel a particular way.
You know, that's a fair statement, because if you go in with high expectations, they come crashing down. But if you go in with those lowered expectations, it's not necessarily a condescending way to approach it even. It's just simply saying, you know, it is what it is kind of thing. And if you go in there, you know, enjoy the Christmas lights, enjoy some of the cute, you know, boy meet girl kind of stuff. Make of the plot twists what you will there. But it moves along. I mean, it has a sense of pace to it. And there are moments of it when we mentioned, you know, in the shop, the banter between the boss and Emilia Clarke as the employee. Some of that is quite enjoyable as it goes back and forth there. My feeling is, though, it milks that material. What I'm getting at ultimately, and this is where I do sound a little bit like Scrooge, but where it bothers me in that respect is, a film like this will have life lessons to impart. And man, are they imparted. You know, it's just like you can't miss, like you think if you turn away from it, no, the life lesson will face you there too, right? You cannot escape this life lesson. And, you know, I'm not the dullest bulb there, but even if I were, I think I got the point. You know, like that's sometimes where the film, and you know, who could be opposed to that life lesson? I'm not. These are like valuable truisms, and I'll support them as well. But sometimes a film like that doesn't know when to let go or just let it be what it is. You know what I'm saying? You get scenes where like, okay, I get it. My feeling is always like, I get it. Now let me go.
Yeah, I think though that maybe it's, I think the moments in the Christmas store, for example, like you said, it does, you know, lead to these self-aware, preachy kind of moments. But it's very effective, I think, because when you're watching Santa, you know, Michelle Yeoh, at first she almost seems like a cartoon character. You know, she says all of the, you know, acerbic things that the wise Asian mentor is supposed to say. But then she has moments where she actually says things that are pretty amazing. And she actually tells her, you know, you selfish girl, at a really key moment when you're thinking that wouldn't have come out. It was brave to put that in the character because it makes her a real person.
That's really incisive, because I didn't like that character the first few times I saw her for the reasons you very well stated, that she seems stereotypical. She's this mean and whatever turned her off or made her bitter in life, and she's really barking at her employee and unreasonable. It's not much fun to be around, right? And then you realize that it morphs into a kind of tough love approach where she can tell, you know, you selfish girl. And
yes.
I like that line reading too.
It worked there.
And then when she opens up, even when it never quite becomes mushy there, but when it becomes warmer between the two of them, emotionally, that actually does work, and I wish the film had more of that. Let's put it that way. That those qualities in the film are promising, and not fully like within Kate's own family with her immigrant family and siblings. Sometimes that is just kind of like in your face, like obvious points being made. I wanted those scenes to be a little more subtle, not quite as clear-cut and kind of stereotypical sometimes in terms of in an immigrant family, how the kids are treated, basically. Some of that was funny, but sometimes in a kind of obvious, brusque way, and I wanted a little more nuance in some of those scenes.
I think this also may have an audience among people who are working at the mall who then want to go take a break and watch a Christmas movie, which talks about what it's like to work during Christmas time with the Christmas stuff and all the music and everything that drives you insane.
You're making it sound sad.
But at the end of the day, this is a movie for people who like George Michael music. If you don't, and if you don't like that song, do not see this movie. But if you do, it's a real pleasure to hear all those songs again and remember, you know, the way that he passed and all the things that he did that were for charity. And it's a good George Michael movie.
Yeah, I actually stayed through the end credits, and listening to the music, it did have that kind of, I won't say nostalgic rush,
but
at least that nostalgic aura that does register by that point.
And it is a popular song. It's been remade by almost everybody I can think of.
It's playing in my head right now.
Sorry about that. Well, thank you for joining us for this episode of At the Movies with Mike and Marie. You can access our previous episodes by going to dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. So we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.